How many of you came to church last week for Sunday school? Yeah. So we ran out of power. We were here, 8:15. We were standing here. Service is going to start, and it just died. Everything just shut off. Now that happens every now and again, but it didn't come back on for a long time. And MedEd didn't know why it was off, and so we had no idea. It was like really, really cold last week too. And so, anyway, we thought about giving a lesson, but then we thought, well, I mean, half the people aren't going to be here, and then it won't even be live streamed, which means it's going to be like a throwaway message. We didn't want to throw one away. So, anyway, Pastor made the hard call, and we just decided let's just do it next week when everyone's here. And you're all here, so it's good to see you. Take your Bibles. We're turning to Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews chapter 12. When I originally gave my announcement for our next Sunday school series in here, I decided not to put a date on because, you know, I never know exactly when we're going to finish, and that was a wise call, apparently. You might notice your handout has the wrong date on it, but that's because it's the exact same one I would have given to you 2 weeks ago, and so instead of reprinting it, I just gave it to you. So this is how long it should have been since we would have met, so that's crazy. But we're going to be in Hebrews chapter 12. We're almost done the book. There won't be any more than four more messages from this book, probably closer to three. Chapter 13 is complicated, but chapter 12 is definitely going to get broke up into two, because chapter 12 has the last warning passage of the book, and so we're going to leave that one for next week at the very, very least. And so we're going to do everything up until that point this morning. This morning's message is not that complicated at all. It's because most of the time, and this is really true in the Bible, most of the time the truths of who God is and what he's done can be difficult to comprehend, right? And the rest of our lives we will spend understanding those things. However, what we're supposed to do today is usually not that difficult to comprehend. Most of us know generally what we're required to do, what we're supposed to do, how we're supposed to live our lives. And so it tends to be, when you read the Bible, the explanation passages in the Bible tend to be more complicated because it gets deep into who God is, what he's done, well, the mysteries that God has revealed to us. And he actually uses that terminology sometimes. But then when you get to the practical section of, so what am I supposed to do with this? Usually they're pretty straightforward. And so it is with Hebrews. He's explained to us why Jesus is better, specifically better than the religiosity that the Jews had. They were holding on to their system more than they were holding on to Jesus. And he says Jesus was better than all of this. Jesus was the end result of all of this. And he comes to Hebrews chapter 11 and says, and so we must have faith. And I said that really when it says that we're supposed to trust, I mean, faith means you're supposed to actually understand and then assent to its truth, but then there's the third element of trust. But that trust element, which is normally what we think of as faith, we normally assign to a mental state. Okay, I trust these things. Just like the whole book, the whole fact that Jesus is better is not just supposed to be a mental state that we live with. It's supposed to be a lifestyle that we live out. And so faith, he explains in chapter 11, is not just a mental state that we have that I ought to trust God, it would dictate our actions. And so to have faith without works, like James would say, would be to have no faith at all. And he gives examples of this in Hebrews 11 by going backwards to all the people that they remember, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, Moses, etc. But the point of Hebrews chapter 11 wasn't to suddenly leave the point of the story and the book and talk about stories that they had in their past. He doesn't embellish those stories very much at all. I mean, the fact that he can fit highlights of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, Moses all into one chapter, however long chapter that chapter may be, goes to prove the point. He's not trying to retell the stories. He's trying to make a point, which is this: that in the past, when people trusted God, it dictated the decisions of their life. And so we knew they had faith. But why does he throw in all these people from the Old Testament when everything about this book is that Jesus is the fulfillment of the Old Testament? Why does he talk about a bunch of people who didn't know Jesus in order to explain to us how we're supposed to live who do know Jesus? To make the simple point, if they lived that way then, how much more should we trust God now, knowing So many of the mysteries that were covered up with them. They didn't know why there was the tabernacle and the temple and the priests and all of those things. They didn't realize it was pointing to Jesus. They didn't know what the better sacrifice is and the better way for God to be with us. And yet they still made those decisions. And somehow we put ourselves to a lower standard than the people in the Bible, don't we? Well, we can't possibly be expected to follow God like Abraham did. I mean, look at all he had. Well, what he's saying is, how much more should we? He says, they, having not even seen the promises, as opposed to us, who have. So that's why chapter 12 is there. Chapter 11 is not an isolated chapter, although we can do an entire sermon series on Hebrews 11, and preachers do. I think it's unwise because the point of it is to get to chapter 12, which is after talking about Abraham's faith and Isaac's faith and Joseph's faith and Moses' faith and how they made active decisions based on their trust in God, not even knowing who Jesus is, unlike us. Chapter 12 talks about you. So that's where we're going to be. And he's going to talk about how we are supposed to practice this faith in our life, an active trust in God, trust that does start in our heart and our minds, but then actually becomes the decisions that we make. But do we have that faith in our life? Can we look in chapter 11 and see the decisions that Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, Moses, and we can't even talk about David and Barak and Samson, like it says there. Do we see those decisions in our life? Because if it was there, true for them, certainly it should be true for us. So we're going to see five components this morning to God's plan for our life. First of all, he's going to say, number one, and we're going to get into our chapter. We're going to spend a lot of time at the first couple verses, and then we're going to finish off with the rest of the section this morning. Number one, our task is to run our race. Our task is to run our race. So let's look at verse number one. This is not independent of chapter 11. It belongs to the same narrative. Remember, chapter and verse divisions were added later so we could navigate. So if I stand up on Sunday morning and say, turn to Hebrews chapter 12, you're all in the same place. That's the only reason that it's there. It roughly breaks apart the sections. This is a section break, for sure. But don't take that and pull the Bible apart into pieces. These do belong together. So verse number one, wherefore, seeing we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us. There's a lot of us there. We were talking about Abraham, now we're talking about us. We're talking about Moses, now we're talking about us. It's really nice to sit and talk about the stories in the Bible, and wow, what a great happy ending. They did the right thing. But what about us, is what he says in Hebrews. And he uses an illustration. He's going to use several illustrations in this chapter, but it's an easy one to wrap our minds around, a race. And in a race, we know what a race is. That's why an illustration is helpful. A race often has obstacles, long, boring stretches of straight path. It has a goal where you're running toward. That is what a race does. Usually in a race, however, you're running against somebody else, right? The point is to beat the other person. And if you're slow, but they're slower, then you're successful. If you're bad, but they're worse, then you're okay. But here, the emphasis of the race is not on trying to beat somebody else. The emphasis of the race here is the fact that there's still the same requirements. We still have to go over the obstacles. We still have to be going down the long, straight stretches of boring path. We still have a goal. That's what he's emphasizing about the race. He's not emphasizing the other people in the race. He's emphasizing what I'm required to do. Because whether I'm running against somebody else or just running against my own time, there's still certain things that I have to do today. And that's what he's pulling out. He's pulling out what my requirements would be to complete the race. The emphasis is not on being better than somebody else, it's on being faithful. In fact, the emphasis is on purpose because this verse is about us, contrasted to the previous chapter, which is about them. And the thing is, I think the previous chapter was helpful, wasn't it? to the extent that when you look at their various stories, each one of their courses, so to speak, were different. I mean, we all have the same requirements, don't we? We're all supposed to keep the same commands, but our course is not the same. I mean, Abraham was not required to lead the children of Israel out of Egypt. That wasn't a part of his course. Moses wasn't required to go into a new land all by himself, nor was he required to lead the people into the promised land later on. Joshua was not intended to be the first king of Israel. David wasn't supposed to be Moses. Everybody is supposed to be them. God had a course for them. And even when you look back at chapter 11, you see that, which makes it true for us as well. His goal for us is to run our race. And the fact is, though we hear it all the time, it still remains true. Each of our races are different. And I don't think we stop and think about all the things that God has put in our path. What is the course that God has set before us? We don't know everything that it will entail, but most of us know what it does entail today, don't we? We do know what God put in our life now and what I'm supposed to do with it. Most of us are looking so far down the path, we're thinking about being faithful later and then at the expense of neglecting our family or neglecting our personal relationship with God or not taking opportunities that God is bringing before us or not serving in the areas that we know that we should. And so we're neglecting our course today. He says, run your race today. Ask yourself this question. If your life was recorded in Hebrews chapter 11, would it be able to say that all the things that were set before you, you were faithful in it? Because that's the point of Hebrews chapter 11. It's just giving you examples. Abraham was asked to do these things. Some of them were hard to understand. Some of them were hard to do, but he was faithful in his course. Moses had a lot of difficult things set before him, but he was faithful in his course. Joseph was faithful in his course. What would we be? Our course is different, but that's not the point, is it? He set before you a race. You need to be faithful in it. Paul could say that, didn't he? 2 Timothy chapter 4, at the end of his life, the last book of the Bible that he wrote, he said, I'm ready to be offered. The time of my departure is at hand. I have fought a good fight. I have finished my course. But what does that really mean? These are just illustrations. I have kept the faith. I did what I was supposed to do that God put in front of me. He got to the end of life, he could say that. So if Paul lived before Hebrews chapter 11 was recorded and his whole life was in the past, they could put Paul in Hebrews chapter 11, it would be appropriate. But could God do that with you? So our task is to run our race. Number two. Our hindrance is our sin and our immaturity. I mean, this whole book is about going on. We were somewhere in the past. God is doing things in our hearts then. He was showing us some things then. A lot of people want to stay there. He said, let us go on unto perfection. And here he's saying we want to run our race. A lot of the things in our life that we allow to be in our life is what's keeping us from running the race. Watch, if the goal is to run the race, then anything in our life that hinders that is our enemy. Look at verse number 1 again. Seeing we are also compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us. Notice how he puts getting rid of the hindrances prior to running the race. Because he wants to emphasize the importance of recognizing that there's things in our life that are stopping that. Some of us want to be good Christians and then maybe later on down the road we'll fix some of the things in our life. Instead of recognizing some things in my life that I need to get rid of if I'm ever going to run this race effectively. We waste days allowing things in our life to stay there. We waste days of running our race, allowing ourselves with pride and with arrogance and with selfishness and with our own agenda, whatever it is, we waste that. He said, so we have to lay those things aside. There's a lot of things we can say about this verse. A lot of things that different people have said about this verse as well. First thing I want to mention is there's several different conversations that come up. And since we're doing a series through the book of Hebrews, I don't want to go by them without mentioning them. First of all, some people differentiate between weight and sin. Look at verse number one. So let us lay aside the weight and the sin which does so easily beset us. And then they say, so weight is something that is in your life that's not wrong, but it's just not helpful. Sin is actually wrong, and therefore it's not helpful. So it'd be like running a race. So imagine you wanted to run a race in the Olympics, and because you really, really wanted to, you decided to wear jeans. You know, big, baggy, heavy jeans. Now, let's just suppose that wasn't against the rules, okay? Would you do that, though, in a race? That wouldn't be what you would wear. That wouldn't be the most helpful thing. It would be a weight. It would be a hindrance. But it wouldn't be wrong, so to speak. A sin would be like breaking rules, and then you get disqualified. Well, that would be wrong. So now you can't run the race effectively because you broke the rules. And the thing is, we can talk about that. There's a certain level of truth to that, that there's things in our life that are wrong that'll hinder our race. There's things in our life that are not wrong, but they're just not helpful. There's a lot of waste in our life, and there's a certain level of truth. However, I think the emphasis of this passage is to differentiate these things for us. Remember, the point of this passage is not to justify ourselves and the things that we're allowing in our life. The point is to run our course effectively. That's it. And so most of the time as Christians, our eyes are not focused on, am I doing what God's asked me to do? Our eyes are focused on what I want to do and what I can get away with. That's what we're focused on. And so with that mindset, we paste that onto verse 1 and say, well, there's sin, and then there's not good stuff, but not sin. And we want to move those apart because we want to say, well, I got some things in my life that aren't great, but they're just not sin. Instead of our eyes being focused on, am I running my course effectively? Because I said this at the beginning of this point. If the goal and the task is to run our course, is to do what God has asked us to do, then anything that hinders that is our enemy. So for us to pull them all apart to justify one and not the other isn't the point. If it's in the way, it's not good. And so we could differentiate those, and I think there's a level of truth to that. But the goal is to win the race. Suppose you miserably lost the race because you wore jeans, and then you consoled all your family who spent time and money helping you train for this race, and you consoled them because although you lost miserably, you didn't break the rules, so it was still honorable loss. It was like, that wasn't the point, was it? The point was to do well, and you didn't. And many of us, maybe you're not living in gross sin. Maybe you're just wasting your life, and you console yourself in that way because you're not living in gross sin. Is that much better if the goal is to do what God's asked us to do and we're not? The hindrance is our sin and our immaturity. We have friends, lifestyles, jobs, hobbies we spend our lives justifying because they're not wrong, and maybe we also have sin in our life as well, and they're keeping us from running our goal. That's the first thing we can mention about that verse. Something else that I want to pull out with this verse, the phrase besetting, the sin that does so easily beset us. And then a doctrine can get pulled out of that that says each one of us has a besetting sin, meaning that you have a sin that is your biggest stronghold, so to speak. That's the one you struggle with. Maybe you don't struggle with this other one so much, but that's the one you struggle with. Okay, maybe that's true. There are some other things we said about that. First of all, no temptation's taken us but such as is common to man. Really, all of us, to some degree, struggle with everything. And when we focus on what we struggle with, sometimes it's easy to think that we don't struggle with the other stuff. And even Paul warns that we should, if we think we stand, we should take heed lest we fall. Well, I don't struggle with stealing. I struggle with lust. Okay, well, then one of these days you might actually struggle with this because you think you're fine. You think you stand. So I don't think that's the greatest mindset to have. I have one sin. At the end of the day, the reason why I think this is not helpful is because the emphasis is on the sin, not on a specific sin in general. Sin is in your life. You live in a world of sin. You live in a world that doesn't love God. You live in a world that hates God. Live in a world that resists God, and that, whatever that is, however that manifests itself, it seeps into your life. And the more we allow it to impact who we are as a human, the more it will hinder our race, and the more we will fail at our task. So we can spend the time nitpicking what it is, but it might show up different in your life. If Satan can get you focused on one thing, then he gets you eyes distracted on the way he can get you tomorrow. The point is, sin besets us. And the idea of besetting actually means it closely clings. It's around. It sticks to us. And if we allow it to, it will hinder us. And that will hinder our race. Sin is what hinders our race. It's always around. It always clings to us. The point remains simple, though, of this verse. There are things, whether our own immaturity that we entertain in our life, or the sin in this world we allow to cling to us, they get us off our path, and they hinder our race. And if our spiritual race is our goal, then any hindrance to that is our enemy. So what are those things in your life? Maybe it's not something specific. Maybe it might be something specific right now, and that might be why you're not doing everything God has asked you to do. Maybe you have some things in your life, specifically, that is eating up your life, that wastes a lot of time in your life, and that's the reason why you've told yourself you can't serve this new year as much as you know you should. Well, there's some things I could do, but I just don't have the time. Well, then you're not running your course effectively. You're spending your life on you, then on Christ. Maybe there's things in your life that are sinful, and they're occupying your mind when your mind should be set on Christ more than it is. And that means you're not running your race effectively. What is it for you? Your hindrance to your race is your sin and your immaturity. Number three, our example is the race of others. Our example is the race of others. Have you ever thought about this, though? I said this when we were in Hebrews 11, I talked about Abraham and Isaac and all those people, and I thought, and I said, isn't it fascinating, though, that they made all those decisions and there was no precedent for that before them? We need to have our Bibles, and we can open up the histories and say, hey, these people did this under these circumstances. They didn't have that, they still did. But here he says, now guys, if they did that without knowing who Jesus was, without knowing what the law was really for, and with having no precedent before that, then certainly you should do right knowing who Jesus is and watch, and having their example before you. That's why he starts. Letter A, we have the example of those gone before. Those gone before. Verse 1, seeing we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses. What is he talking about? He's talking about Hebrews 11. We have all of these examples of people who were given a task and they were faithful in it, even though they didn't know the end result, even though they didn't understand everything, they were. Are you? That's what he's asking. The Bible says in 1 Corinthians 10:11, all these things, talking about the stories of the children of Israel. Prior to that, he lists a bunch of things that they did wrong. He says, all these things happened unto them for in samples. And they were written for our admonition upon whom the ends of the world are come. Our fellows are going to come by here in a second. Take your attendance slip, if you would. Make sure your name's on it. And drop that in the offering plate when they go around, just so we know who's here. The Bible has so much history, so that we can see in a variety of different circumstances, in different historical periods, with different cultures, that they followed God. Very few things will we face in our life without an example of something relevant in the Bible that deals with it. That's why they give you so many stories of them. Somebody else has dealt with something similar to you. The fact is, sometimes we say, well, that was in Bible times. You know how naive it is to even use the term Bible times? The Bible was written over a course of 1,500 years. The Bible's history spans over 4,000 years. The term Bible times doesn't really mean a whole lot because there's a lot of cultural change during that time, a lot of advancement in society. It takes place in different countries with different laws, different things going without saying, different things that are normal, different things that are important, different governments in charge, different rituals, different traditions. Why do I say that? Because we want to separate ourselves from Bible times as if it was all one time. The Bible, maybe one of the reasons the Bible spans so much time is to show us that it doesn't matter what culture, who's in charge, what's happening, you can still follow God. I mean, the time of Abraham is not the same as the time of Jesus. It is vastly different the way that it would be to live in that world. And yet, the truths remain the same. And if that is so obvious when we read the Bible, then should not it be obvious for us? Well, things are different. Things are always different. Things are going to get different. Things were different. Things weren't different. Things were different than they were yesterday. That's not an excuse not to follow the Lord. We have a great cloud of witnesses, not just a few at one time where it was easy to serve God. We have a great cloud of witnesses from a lot of people across a large period of time when it was difficult to serve God. We had examples of other people. The letter B, then he moves on to the example of Jesus, who endured so much more. Jesus, who endured so much more. Verse number 2. I'm going to get back to this phrase in a second, so don't think I'm going over it. Verse 2. Looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who, for the joy that was set before him, endured the cross, despising the shame, and is sat down on the right hand of the throne of God. Now, what I love about that verse, you know what it just said? Jesus, the Son of God, had a course. There was something that was set before him. I mean, wasn't that like the theme of most of his ministry? This is what I am here to do. He was fully aware, this is why I'm here. And so every decision that I make, every person I surround myself with, every place that I go, everything I fill my life with, what I buy or don't buy, is all governed by the fact that I have a job God is giving me to do. So for the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down on the right hand of God. He came, he ran his course, he humbled himself, and he was exalted and rewarded for it. What a great microcosm of what our story is. God gives us a course, we're supposed to humble ourselves to it, and he will reward us if we're faithful to it. Well done. Verse 3, for consider him that endured such contradiction of sinners against himself, lest ye be wearied and faint in your minds. I can't do it. It's impossible. Well, look at Jesus' story. Well, he was really popular. Okay, for a very small amount of his ministry, he was very popular. And the reason he was popular, because of what people could get out of him. That was why he was popular. He actually says that. One of the most popular moments of his life was around the time of the feeding of the 5,000. So that can be a good indicator for you as you're reading through your Bible, because those two would be obvious to go together. That happens in every single gospel, by the way, which is actually rare. But in John chapter 6, which is where that story shows up, at the end of that chapter, they're running after him again. He gets back in the boat, goes across the Sea of Galilee, goes into a town, and they're all chasing after him. And Jesus says to this, you don't seek me for who I am. You seek me because, you know, you got bread and you were fed. That's why you're here, because you're hungry again. You want to eat dinner. And so he says, you know what you need? You need me. I am the bread of life. But see, they didn't want him. They wanted dinner. And that's what most of us do. And so anyway, so that's a side note. But the point is, with Jesus, we're like, well, he was popular. No, he wasn't. As soon as he started to preach those things, if you don't eat of me, I am your sustenance, not all this stuff in the world. Then people walked away no more with him. Yeah. That was what the end of chapter 6 was. Yeah. When that story ended, most people left him because he said this wasn't the point. Jesus was not popular, but he did what he was supposed to do. And he was rewarded for it. Jesus was not popular in his life, and yet became the most influential character in all of history. Why? Because it's not about today, how I feel today. It's about what has God asked me to do. And there is no better reward than being faithful in that. He says, so when you're weary and you faint in your minds, look unto Jesus, who was faithful in his course. Verse number 4, ye have not yet resisted with unto blood, striving against sin, but I feel like I'm dealing with stuff that's worse than Jesus. Okay, if you're alive, then no, you haven't, okay? Jesus was crucified. That was part of his course. If you're not there yet, then you haven't quite gotten there, which means you can always be more like Jesus, and there's always more he can help you do. Jesus is our ultimate example. Actually, the Bible tells us that. Jesus says to his disciples when he's serving, John chapter 13, he says, I have given you an example that ye should do as I have done to you. The book of Peter talks about his suffering. Even hereunto were ye called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that we should follow his steps. The fact that Jesus did it isn't an excuse that we shouldn't be required to do it also. Jesus came as a man for one of the reasons to be that he could give us an example of how to live as a human in this world, the best way. The fact that he was God and man doesn't mean he was less human. The fact that he was a man not filled with sin means that Jesus was more human than any of you and I are. He did it the right way, and we can follow his steps. So look at the examples. Number four, our goal and our motivation is Jesus. Verse number two, told you I was going to come back to this. Looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. In addition to Jesus being a great example, Jesus is the goal. Every race has a finish line, somewhere where they are going, something they are trying to reach. We don't just run for the sake of running. We run towards a goal. And as they run their race, they look toward their goal. And he says to us, we're running our race, look unto Jesus. He is the author and finisher of our faith. This is what Paul says in Philippians. Paul says, I count all things but loss for the excellency of the knowledge of Christ Jesus my Lord, for whom I have suffered the loss of all things and do count them but dung that I may win Christ. Everything that hinders my race, which ends in knowing Jesus more, is a hindrance to me. It is my enemy. That's what he said. I caught all things but dung. This is, by the way, this is after he finished giving all his credentials. I was a Hebrew of Hebrews, a Pharisee. I was blameless concerning the law. If his pride was a hindrance to him knowing Jesus more, then it was a problem. And we, verse 13, brethren, I count not myself to have apprehended, but this one thing I do, forgetting those things which are behind, which, by the way, in this instance, was good things. It wasn't bad things. We use this verse to say, forget all your past failures. And there's precedent for that. But here he's saying, I'm not going to look at all the things I have done. I forget those things which are behind and reach forth unto those things which are before. I press toward the mark for the prize of the high calling of God in Christ Jesus. Our goal in our Christian race is Jesus. It is to know him more and to make him known. It is to please and is to obey him. He is the goal. But for most people, that's not their goal. For most people, the goal is to be good people. And so what does that turn out to look like in our life? It often translates into being more religious, doing more things, doing more stuff. Pasting more religiosity in our life. And this is what the Jews were, weren't they? How can you possibly say that they were doing what they were supposed to doing if their first question was, should I follow Jesus or just follow my religion? He's saying this is the start of it all. Jesus is the goal. If Jesus isn't your goal, I don't know what race you're running. But most of us, that isn't our goal. It's to appear good before the people. It's to conform to the system. And if it's not the system, then it's bad. And this is where the Jews were. I was like, well, this isn't the way we do it, so I'm going to reject it, even though in the process of them rejecting what was given to them, to accept the system, they had to reject Jesus for the sake of being a good person, because Jesus wasn't their goal. Watch, Jesus wasn't better to them. Something else was. Jesus is the goal. The problem with that is sometimes the system is outdated. The system is never the goal. As the Israelites needed to leave Judaism behind for the sake of Jesus, so we need to do likewise. It is not about being religious. It is about being like Christ. But it's interesting, before we move on to the next section, that we recognize that Jesus calls himself the author and the finisher of our faith. He's the author of our faith. Because of everything we've learned in this book, everything in the Old Testament was all to point to him. Everything he accomplished on the cross initiates that this life is even available to you. But not only is he the author of our faith, he's the finisher of our faith. It is through his power we can run the race. We will fail without him. If we want a way to God without a great high priest, we don't have one. If we want a way to help us deal with our sins without the sacrifice that Jesus says, just like it said a couple chapters ago, there is no sacrifice for sins anywhere else. If we want to have this race without Jesus, we will fail because it was only through Jesus that makes it possible. He is the author and he's the finisher of our faith. And so we look unto him. Now, number five, God's instrument for training is chastisement, which is a dirty word. He said that he would help us finish our race. But a race is not a sprint. Life is a series of decisions, not a single step or a single day or a single event. So we need help. So let's read the rest of our section here, and then we'll say some things about it before we're done. Verse number five. And ye have forgotten, he says, the exhortation which speaketh unto you as unto children, my son. Despise not thou the chastening of the Lord, nor faint when thou art rebuked of him. For whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth, and scourgeth every son whom he receiveth. If you endure chastening, God dealeth with you as with sons. For what son is he whom the Father chasteneth not? But if ye be without chastisement, whereof all are partakers, then are ye bastards and not sons. You're illegitimate, he says. Furthermore, we have had fathers of our flesh, which corrected us. We gave them reverence. Shall we not much rather be in subjection unto the Father of spirits and live? For they verily for a few days chastened us after their own pleasure, after their own decisions, after their own will, their own wisdom. But he for our profit, that we might be partakers of his holiness. Now, he says the obvious. No chastening for the present seemed to be joyous, but grievous. Nevertheless, afterward, it yieldeth the peaceable fruit of righteousness unto them which are exercised thereby. Wherefore, lift up the hands which hang down and the feeble knees, and make straight paths for your feet, lest that which is lame be turned out of the way, but let it rather be healed. We hear the word chastisement, and we hear the word punish and discipline, and we don't like that word. But think for a second about the word discipline. We use that word in a variety of different contexts, don't we? Discipline meaning I'm going to discipline my children. Sometimes we use it in context of training, like, I don't know, for a race. And we discipline ourselves. We have to be disciplined in our routine. Well, the reason why we use those terms in different contexts is because at the end of the day, they actually really mean the same thing. Training, discipline, and chastisement are all part of the same thing. Now, the word that's interesting about the word chastisement is it comes from, It comes from a word that's very, very, very closely related in the Greek language to the word for children. Why? Because the word doesn't necessarily mean punishment. It means everything that is entailed in training a child to live. The word chastisement has a broad variety of applications. Because when we train our children to live life, there's a lot of things that we have to teach them. A lot of areas where there's rebuke and direction, correction and instruction. And all of that is our training. That's the word for chastisement here. Just for the sake of it, Thayer, in his lexicon of the Greek language, to this word says this word is the whole training and education of children, which relates to the cultivation of mind and morals, and employs for this purpose now commands and admonitions, and now reproof and punishment. He says everything. And that's what he does for us. Now, why is this important? In this chapter, what he has done is effectively changed his illustration. He's used a term that connects to running a race, but he's ended up changing it to talking about how a father trains his children. Why? Because what is our race? Our race is our life. It's what we're doing in our life. And so just as a father trains his child for life, so we need to take the training that God gives us to live right, to live life, to run our course, to be faithful in what God set before this. Now, by the way, he reminds the Hebrews that this they already know. Go back to verse number 5. He says this, ye have forgotten the exhortation which speaketh unto you as unto children. Now, the rest of verse 5 and the rest of chapter verse 6 is actually a quotation from another place in the Bible. That's why he says they've forgotten it, because they already knew it. My son, despise not thou the chastening of the Lord, or faint when thou art rebuked of him. Whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth, and scourgeth every son whom he receiveth. This comes from Proverbs chapter 3. This was embedded in their culture long before. Talking about how God trains us. I mean, look at verse number 5 of Proverbs chapter 3. Trust in the Lord with all thine heart. In all thy ways, verse 6, acknowledge him. Verse 7, be not wise in thine own eyes. Fear the Lord and depart from evil. Verse 8, why? Because it'll be better for you. He tells you how to handle your money. Verse 9, honor the Lord with thy substance, and then God will take care of you. Now, verse 11 and 12 of Proverbs 3, that's where the quotation comes from. My son, despise not the chastening of the Lord, neither be weary of his correction. For whom the Lord loveth, he correcteth, even as a father the son in whom he delighteth. Why does he put that in there? Proverbs is sometimes broken up into tiny little piecemeal bits, but sometimes they all belong together. And in Proverbs chapter 3, a lot of those verses all have to do with this. Many of you follow yourself and not the Lord. It'll be better for you if you follow the Lord. It'll be health to your navel, marrow to your bones, he said. Many of us are wise in our own eyes. And we think that we have it under control. And so we don't follow the Lord, we follow us. And so watch, when the Lord corrects us and trains us, we say that it's unnecessary. And we don't follow it. This leads me to the rest of it. We'll have to go quickly. But it's not hard, so we'll be done very fast. Letter A, it's motivated by fatherly love. Fatherly love. Verse 6, whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth. And scourgeth every son whom he receiveth. If you endure chastening, God dealeth with you as with sons. For what son is he whom the father chasteneth not? But if ye be without chastisement, whereof all are partakers, then are ye bastards and not sons. He says, you want to have no correction in your life? What you're saying is, I don't want to be God's child. That's what you're saying. There's no child that God doesn't correct and train, because God loves, and so he trains to do well. And he doesn't train and chasten and correct those who are not his children. You know, we all know that parent who decides to take upon themselves to be the father of all of their town and the children and the mother of all of their town. But God is the father who points at the other kids and then looks at his own kids and say, hey, this is what you should do in that situation next time. He trains his children. If God is training you, bringing things into your life, and he's speaking to your heart and saying, this is because of this, you shouldn't be going this way, you should be doing the right thing. He brings things into your mind. He reminds you of things that you do or that you're doing wrong. It's because he loves you. Because he doesn't want you to fall off into a ditch. Fatherly love. Letter B. The end is to make us holy. To make us holy. Why does he do it? Because he wants us to be like him, all that we can be. Verse number 9. Furthermore, we have had fathers of our flesh which corrected us. We gave them reverence. Shall we not much rather be in subjection to the Father of spirits and live? For they verily for a few days chastened after their own pleasure, but he for our profit, that we might be partakers of his holiness. No chastening for the present seems to be joyous, but grievous. Nevertheless, afterward, it yieldeth the peaceable fruit of righteousness, watch, unto them which are exercised thereby. You're not going to get it unless you submit to it. We'll get to that in a second. But what is the goal? The goal is to be like him. I'll give you a passage in 1 Peter 1 where it talks about how God brings trials into our life like fire and gold. But he says we rejoice in those seasons. Why? Because we know that it works in our life to make us better. So it's a good thing, he says. Let us see. The Christian's response can vary. God is unchangeable, but you and I are not. And so God can deal with us faithfully. How you react to it is entirely up to you. Now remember, what's the goal? The goal is to be like Jesus and to run our race to please him. What God has set before us, be faithful in it. The reason we don't like chastening is because that's not our goal. Our goal is to be comfortable today. And so when that is violated, we feel violated. If the goal is to run a race effectively, then training is welcomed. But we can respond in different ways. Number one, we can despise it. We can despise it. Now, remember, he doesn't ever say that it's easy. No chastening for the present time is joyous. It's grievous. He recognizes that. But we can despise it. Look, go back to verse number 5. My son, he said, you've forgotten this. My son, despise not thou the chastening of the Lord. Now, the word despise doesn't mean to hate. It means to lightly esteem, to think little of. Why is that important? So, I'm not athletic, but so I look at gym class from afar. But my wife, she taught gym class at our school. When she was teaching in the school, she's taking care of Levi now, but last year when she was teaching in the class, you could tell the difference between the students who respected her as a teacher and those who lightly esteemed her instruction. So we'll learn something in gym class, how to hold a bat, how to shoot a basketball, whatever, and you can tell the difference between the two. The one will actually attempt to do what they were told to do. They will attempt to have the same form that they were instructed to have. They attempt to do the same steps they were instructed to do. And then when she corrects them, it's like, do it this way, they take it well. And they try better next time. Then you have the student who lightly esteems the instruction. And so when they are told how, what kind of form to have, how to shoot the basketball, they will still shoot it like they always have. And then when she corrects them or whatever, they take it personally. Like it's a personal slight against themselves that they had done it wrong, even though they didn't actually respect the instruction to actually try to do it. They lightly esteemed it. And so then they didn't take correction, and then it just gets more tension because they didn't think the instructions were important. It was a waste of time. I've always shot a basketball like this, and I've beat one-on-one against my little sister every time. And so why bother changing? And the thing is, this is what we do with God. God says, no, I know you've been living this way, but this is how to live. And we say, why is that important? And so we lightly esteem the chastisement and the instruction and the training. We don't even attempt to apply it in our life. So then God corrects us and we take it personally. It's a slight against us. God doesn't like me. Why is he against me? Why does he love them more than me? And why does that all start? Because we despise his chastening. Why do I have to be told what to do when I can just do as I please? We despise it. Number two, we can submit to it. We could submit to it. Verse 9, furthermore, we had fathers of our flesh which corrected us, and we gave them reverence. Shall we not much rather be in subjection under the Father of spirits and live? I mean, if we respect our parents and we respect our teachers, why shouldn't we respect God who actually knows everything? And then submit to it, which is the opposite. So we don't have to go with that. Number three, this is the last thing that can happen in our life. We can despise it. I don't need that. I'm not going to submit to it. I'm not going to bother. It's a waste of time. It's unnecessary. Then we could submit to it and say, God knows better than I do, and so I will attempt to follow his instructions and to respond to his training. But number three, we can faint under it and leave the race. We can faint under it. He says, despise not the chastening of the Lord, or faint when thou art rebuked of him. Look at the end of that chapter section, verse 12 and 13. Wherefore, lift up the hands which hang down, and the feeble knees, make straight paths for your feet, lest that which is lame be turned out of the way, but let it rather be healed. After a while, he says, some people, they just drop out. They attempted to run the race. They just didn't finish their course like Paul did. They started their course. They responded to some days and weeks and years of training. But after a while, they just got tired of it because they got their eyes off of Jesus. He was no longer the goal. And so they fainted. They got tired of it, and they turned out of the way. Some Christians take it lightly, some take it seriously. Others just don't take it permanently. This is not who they are. It's something they're trying. Christianity and following what Jesus is and who he is and instilling who he is into my life and my decisions is a temporary thing that I'm going to participate in for a while. They choose to be a spectator after some time and after some years of trying. Why? Because the goal was not worth it to them. Apparently, Jesus was not enough. Jesus was not better. Run your race and stay in it. That's what he says to you. The point is very simple. God has given us all kinds of examples of people who did it in the past with much less than we have. And we have Jesus. So what is your race right now? What is God asking you to do? What's God set before you that you don't feel like doing? Then you have to ask yourself the question, what is my goal in life? What is the purpose of my life? The purpose of our lives many times is to be comfortable, to be accepted, but he says the purpose of our life is to know Jesus. And if that is our goal, our race will be important, and anything that's in our way will be our enemy, and any training will be welcomed if we think that way.